I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
Herculean determination, a bold vision, and a high tolerance for risk are the hallmarks of an entrepreneur who can drive their startup business out of port into the sea of success. They build a team of people who translate and execute their vision into reality by filling in their administrative gaps. They are the proverbial celebrity chefs, supported by vegetable washers, waiters, and hosts, or the kidney surgeon, surrounded by an OR team of anesthesiologists, nurses, and physician assistants. But how does a company survive and thrive after the founding CEO moves on? When is the right time to start planning for the CEO's eventual exit? How does the company transition from a startup fueled by brute force of will, genius, and daring, to a mature organization run on KPIs, policies, and processes? My next guest on the Business of Intuition is a CEO coach for leaders in private mid-market firms with 50 to 200 million in revenue. Steve Brody is a former VP of marketing for Coca-Cola, and since then has focused on helping CEOs reach their potential and determine what to do after they leave the top role. He is a Vistage Master Chair and author of the book, What Happens After the Sale. The intersection of leadership, strategic plans, and exit planning contains the answer to the question, how does a company survive and thrive after the CEO moves on? Steve Brody on the Business of Intuition. So, Steve, it's a real delight to have you on the Business of Intuition. And, you know, you've got such a long history in working with teams and organizations. I wanted to get into a question about the CEO who's about ready to exit. And that's the context. And so as I was thinking about this interview, I was remembering my father and my stepfather right near the end of their lives. They both have passed on, and they both ended in very different ways. My father had a hard time letting go of life and was struggling with that realization, whereas my stepfather just sort of seemed to be at peace with it and went off into the sunset, so to speak, metaphorically, with great grace. And I realized that they kind of ran their lives the way they passed away, or the way they passed away was very similar to the way they ran their lives. And so I'm wondering, from your perspective, as a CEO, metaphorically speaking, sort of decides to let go, do you feel that the way they let go is sort of an indication about how they led, whether they were able to engage their teams, whether they were able to empower people, or were they controlling too much? I mean, What do you learn from CEOs who decide to leave and decide to retire or to step away? What do you glean from that process? What does it tell you about how they led their companies up to that point?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. And I think it really is reflective, Dean, of who they are. And what I mean by that is, What is that behavior, or what is that personality like? So let's step back a little bit in that the frame of reference and the kind of activity that I'm predominantly involved with now are people that are in the private marketplace, or founders and companies that are privately owned. And you know, many of those that I think are similar with some of your kind of clients too. But I want to differentiate those from people that were executives in very, very large companies, and maybe those were publicly traded companies, because there's different environments to what does succession look like, or what does an ending look, you know, there's much more planning involved or alternatives in those that have large groups of advisors, meaning a board of directors. And in the audience today that I'm focused on, and I think many of the affiliates that I know are really concentrated on the market that's privately held. So if we go back to your question about, does it differ from how they led? It really, I think, is a reflection of the way their own personality behaves when they're interacting with people, with a team, and how they view their own, how they view their situation. So you use the phrase of like letting go. Now, that can be a very interesting one that crosses over more than one meaning. Initially, you were talking about relative to an exit or letting go.
Right.
But let's think about it a little bit in the broader sense, meaning, do they let go with decisions or delegation or the way they're interacting with people? Because I think that has the same kind of characteristic. Mm. And some people are just very, very controlling. I mean, for whatever reason, it's just what they're comfortable with. And, you know, I wouldn't say that's necessarily the best leadership style, but it probably comes out of their personality, of the way they interact.
So would it be advantageous for a CEO to be planning their exit long before it would ever happen, because it would not only make that transition more effective, but they could also be creating a kind of bench underneath them that is needed and useful even today?
The answer to that is yes. And it's really needed for several reasons. Not just the bench, but let's think for a moment about the kinds of alternatives that there are with respect to exit. And in that kind of work, in that kind of advising that I do with an organization that I'm involved with, they define this particular group or people that are exit planning specialists, and they define four categories, if you will, or characteristics of type of exits. But let me just focus on the first one, which tends to be the one that is the most in need of preparation relative to the question you asked. And the one that's most in need of preparation is a sale to an outside group of people, a sale to an outside company, or let's call it a strategic buyer. Now, that could be a financial buyer, someone who's not in the industry or in that business, or someone who already is in that industry or business. But the defining definition of that is the sale to an outside buyer requires a lot of preparation. And that means, depending on the nature of whatever the company, you said it may, you know, one of your father or stepfather's business or someone, depending on how they ran their business and how small or large they were, the level of preparation often depends on what they're doing for their own management. Now, what do I mean by that? Do they prepare very disciplined financials? Do they have very disciplined performance measures? Do they have outside audits? Are they required to have outside audits for some reason? Or do they have audits and dealings with their accounting firms and financial advisors because they just feel that it's a good thing to have? Well, those kind of things are examples of something that to an outside buyer, that's very important.
Yeah.
And then the consequence of that means you really can't do that and do it well in a short period of time. What do I mean by short? Let's say 6 months or less. It's just almost impossible. Or unless you're in a crisis or something that you don't have much control and you have to do something, it'll have a significant impact on maybe what the valuation or the type of alternatives that get presented to you. So when I say 6 months or less, that's really short.
It's really tight. Yeah, that's all part of the due diligence process that you would expect the company to go through. Yeah.
So what would you like to have? What would someone like to have? Here's where you get into this range. But I would say, and from deals that I've seen, clients that I've been involved with, plus others in this group that I'm attached to, which is called Navix, N-A-V-I-X, what I would like to see is a time frame of 1 to 3 years. 1 to 3 years.
That a CEO would start his or her exit plan.
Of some of the steps of the, let's think about it like a roadmap. Let's think about the exit plan as there are numerous steps that need to be done if someone's going to exit in a very favorable way. And numerous steps, meaning there's easily six to 10 different type of milestones that have to be looked at. Well, those things aren't going to be done in 60 days or less. That is just not going to happen. Some of them may mean, let's say the company's never had an audit. And if it's and that's what I'm referring to the outside buyer as the one that has the most due diligence that's going to be needed. So an audit may be required by the potential buyer. Well, those things, that doesn't take just 2 or 3 weeks. That's going to take, maybe 2 months or so. And so those elements or milestones that we would find along the roadmap are going to help define what that amount of time would be if someone has the opportunity to plan it out. And that's what I'm referring to when I say 1 to 3 years.
So aside from me getting the business ready for, say, an outside buyer, if I go back to this idea that there's a CEO who is eventually going to move on, at what point does he or she need to start planning their replacement? Maybe it's within the company. Maybe it has nothing to do with a sale. It just means I'm going to retire, but I need to find somebody to take over. At what point should they start really actively working on that?
I would say at least 12 to 18 months and maybe to 24 months. Because when you're looking at the human talent needs, when you're looking at the availability of how you think about that, of do you have people inside that maybe are ready or that need to be groomed or trained, or do you make a decision that maybe you don't have the right kind of people inside to go to these next steps, and you decide I need to supplement my team. I need to bring somebody in from the outside to be a successor. Well, that's not a 60-day activity.
No.
You could find someone in maybe 60 to 90 days, but to get someone ready and understand your business, and it comes back to that same, it's really a minimum of 12 to 18 months, unless you're under some kind of crisis. If you're under, then you're going to do what you're going to do what you have to.
So it seems to me in the work that we do that this process of finding one successor is more successful if it's not a popularity contest and we don't just reward loyalty, which we sometimes do. You've been around the longest, you get to take the reins of the company, but that there's some sort of set of criteria, competencies, if you will, that we would view or consider candidates for that top position. What's your sense of that? And are companies doing that in your mind, or is it still pretty much something more based on loyalty?
Oh, I think the good ones have really moved beyond loyalty. And I say that, but that's not an easy. It's not an easy thing to do. So depending on I would say that there is a correlation, not a causal factor, but a correlation. Maybe you see this with some of the organizations you're involved with, a correlation to the size of the company. And what I mean by that is likely the smaller the company, the smaller the company, I believe, and in the instances that I've seen, it tends to be a little bit closer to a loyalty or a beauty contest.
Sure, sure.
The larger the organization, the thinking becomes a little bit more of are there alternative choices, and who do I look to possibly groom or train, and then how do I go about that? So one of the areas, I mean, I can relate to one from a long time ago when I went through early on in the first phase of my career, which was in the corporate world with a major, you know, company who was in the top 50 of publicly traded companies. But I was in the marketing department, marketing and product management, and had a very intentional discussions with some of the other people on developing my own leadership and exposure that I needed to spend some dedicated time in the sales department. And as you think about and look at larger companies, you know, there is this interesting love-hate relationship between the marketing departments and the sales department. So depending on who the company is, like, who's in charge of the budget, who is setting pricing, who is, and so, you know, that, and the truth is, it's kind of a left arm, right arm type of characteristic, because if it's a packaged goods company, and that's what it was in this instance, most of those were developed under the Procter & Gamble model, followed that same kind of model of brand management and product management, where the marketing people were the ones that really made a large percentage of the important decisions.
Well, sure, they're strategic. Yeah,
they're more strategic.
Yeah,
but they can't exist and they can't execute those decisions well without the right kind of sales department.
Right
now, so the truth in that example that I'm describing, the truth becomes: how does someone really get groomed to become a more effective leader, other than just working with someone in the organization that's in the sales department? Well, what I was placed in the position of, and in the beginning, I reacted really quite negatively to it. Why is someone doing this? You're going to sidetrack my career. They wanted me actually to move into the sales department and take on a role that was fairly high, but a role within the sales department. And the truth is, afterwards and after doing that, it was really one of the best things that I ever did. And coming into it, I really felt that this was almost something that someone was saying there was something missing, that I needed to be punished to move out of marketing and move into sales.
So was it good because you learned a different part of the business?
Well, it was good because I would say, I think, there's nothing like gaining an appreciation for what someone has to do, a peer or an affiliate, without you actually walking in their shoes.
In their shoes, yeah.
And you do, and you realize now, you know what? This isn't so easy in the sales department.
That's great, because if you'd stayed in the sales department forever, I suppose you would have continued to have your perspectives about marketing that was not necessarily accurate.
That's
a really great point. I want to talk a little bit, or get your thoughts on founders within companies. People who was the genius that got the ball rolling. They are the creative force. They're the ones who came up with and had the courage to make it happen. Maybe they're also the rainmaker to be able to bring in the business, and it starts to grow. And you have people. You have a long-standing set of clients, but it's still really focused a lot on the brand and the delivery of the founder. What sort of recommendations do you have for those people who know that there is a ceiling because they can't live forever, and that they want to start to hand off more? They want to make themselves, in a sense, less important, but it's a very hard thing to do because you're also training your customers to see you differently as well. Any sort of recommendations you may have for those founders who need to back away in order for their company to scale?
Yeah, there are. And so there are two that I would say come to mind that I've come across in dealing with with private owners, with founders and private owners. So one, let me go back to the what I mentioned earlier as to the behavior side. You know, one of the things that you and I talked about a little earlier was the need for understanding what someone's behavior or characteristics look like to those they work with and to other people. And how do you go about doing that? You know, in today's world, there's a pretty well-developed field, and it's fairly hot activity, actually, of assessments, of a variety of personality assessments. And those can be very valuable. I use one that's called the Berkman profile, but there's a number of well-known ones, Myers-Briggs and DISC and others.
Yes.
Well, these are very helpful instruments. And so one component of what you're asking is I think the individual has to get in touch with what their own behavior looks like and what they're comfortable with. And some of these tools are very helpful tools. It's not a silver bullet. It's not a prescription, because it doesn't give you a formula that says, oh, by the way, Dean, you need to act in the following way. It doesn't do that. What it really helps someone tune into is, what is the way or the behavior that you are comfortable acting and that you're going to always resort back to, because it's in your DNA. It's in the DNA. So it comes back to a very interesting discussion. Is it nature or nurture? Is it, and truth is, it's pieces of both of those. So number one, understanding what that behavior is that you have and what you enjoy and what you're passionate about. I think that's one of the components that's really important before somebody can figure out how to let go or help develop someone else, because they have to look at what area do they need a lot of complementary skill around them, or said another way, what area can they more easily give? You know, sometimes you have someone who's just a genius, and I'm not talking about IQ necessarily.
Yeah,
but someone just may have this natural ability to be the creative one, to be the chemist, to be the one that does all the formulas, the one. But you know, maybe they don't want to ever give that up because it's part of who they are. It's part of what they love. But by definition, once they see that, they're going to realize that that's probably why they don't like to spend a lot of time in the financial and administrative area, in the controls area, in the disciplines and standards area. But the bigger you get and the more compliance you need on certain things with your industry, you almost are going to have to be dependent on other people. So I think coming back to your remark is, what I'm saying is, you have to know where you function well and what you're comfortable with. And then that can help you to look at what is it that you have to complement around you so that you can easily let go of that.
Well, that's a great point. You know, you've got a creative individual who is the big visionary of whatever it is you're doing, and you can now all of a sudden hire the financial person. I have this on my team, right? I've got people who complement my skills because I am not as strong in that, and in fact, we all kind of create a whole because we have different pieces that need to work in tandem. That being said, though, let's say I am the creative person, I'm the founder, I'm getting up in age, I'm thinking it's time to start looking at disconnecting from my company, but I'm so inextricably connected to the clients, to the offering, and I'm comfortable doing it. And I have the team that helps support me to do it, but the company can't last forever so long as it's set up for me being the primary creative juice regarding that. How do we help those founders replace themselves?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you've really touched upon a very, very important factor. And so, you know, let's go back to, it does revert back to the kind of behavior and the personality that I said, for them to get in tune with themselves as to what they're comfortable with. So that's one big piece of it that I mentioned before. But let me get a little bit more mechanical, I would say, about it. And what I mean by mechanical, this now depends with that individual, with that founder now, Dean, what's the situation with that person? Now, what I'm meaning by that is, when I say what's the situation, over X number of years, as they're getting closer to that exit, have they taken a lot of money on a regular basis outside of the business? Have they been able to take cash out into their personal net worth and still not damage the company or whatever the company needed for growth and capital expenditures and all of that? But all along, have they funded quite a bit of their own net worth, which some mm-hmm. people do? Some mm-hmm. people do, and just depends on the profit level and the alternatives that they have available to do that. Or have they been the kind of person who is just constantly reinvesting because they want this, they have this ambition for the company to get bigger and bigger or be more important and deal with new technologies or new areas of opportunities? And they've been constantly investing over a long period of time and not taking personal wealth out, because now, depending on the answer to you, think of that as a continuum, if you will, those that have taken a lot out and those that haven't taken a lot out. Now, as they get closer to that exit, we get into a bunch of personal questions. What's their age and what are they going to look at doing for the rest of their life? And we have to actually do a financial plan, meaning how much will they need? So now, instead of just a company plan, we have to do a financial plan for Mr. or Mrs. CEO, because this now will determine how much money do they need at exit, or do they actually not need an enormous amount of money at exit because they already have created a sizable net worth. So depending on the answer of where they fall along that continuum, that is really going to generate different degrees of the amount of time that's necessary, depending on the answer to that. They may have an opportunity to do it differently, you know?
Right. Now, that's all good advice. I mean, in terms of being able to be mechanical about how you plan your exit whenever that comes about. Let's say here, I want to ask you this, because this is really in my mind right now because of some situations that we're dealing with some clients. But let's say I am comfortable being in control. I like that. And that's where the business has thrived. I've made a lot of the key decisions. The company has lasted for maybe decades based on that model. And now I have this notion that I would like to be able to have it survive me. But I also have this other knowledge about my behavior, which is I'm comfortable being in control. So my sense at sometimes is that these are two separate goals, or these are two separate characteristics that are at odds with each other. One is I want to be able to have the company survive me, which means I have to let go. On the other hand, I'm very, very comfortable being in control. And if the flip side is true, I have a hard time letting go. How does one in that situation come to terms with that duality?
How do you come to terms? So I'm going to give you a comment, and I'm not being facetious about the comment.
Oh, that's okay.
I don't come out of, my background is not one of therapy. I actually come out of a background in my graduate studies of the organizational behavior and you know, how does the personality of the person, and so a lot of the Peter Drucker stuff and a lot of his books that were written about a company is a society, a company is a culture and an entity. So, but what I'm alluding to when you say how do you come to grips with that, it's very possible that you may need a really, really good therapist.
or a coach like yourself.
And I'm not saying that to be to be pejorative. I'm not saying
no, I get it.
Critical of the person that you're a that bad person, but you may need support in that, you know, because
I think you're right, Steve. I really do, because I do see that showing up where they seem to be at cross purposes. I want this company to grow without me, but I don't want to let go of it. You know, so I have to somehow.
If that's the case, that in what you're asking, if someone is like that, that's a really difficult exiting. That's a really if it's going to go to an outsider. Now, one of the other alternatives is it doesn't go to an outsider. It goes to an inside team. And what that one is called, you know, it's referred to often as an MBO. What that means is that's a management buyout. So I'm not going to sell the company to some outsider, but I've got this team of people that have been with me that I've groomed. Maybe they're very different than I am. Maybe I'm the creative person and they're the analytical person or they're the process person. And so you made this. And let's say I have taken out a high degree of net worth, my own personal net worth over the years. Well, then a very interesting thing could happen. That individual may not be so driven by how giant is this exit in terms of dollars, because the person already has got the net worth accumulated. So that kind of individual might be very willing to be able to turn over to a management buyout or an internal person in a more subtle way. And that can be a lot faster, because then you already have. You have somebody who's a part of the relationship they've been with you. Now, you mentioned another comment that I want to just tie to this one, because you said, what if there's a certain number of customers or the concentration of the business? And that's a big one. That's a big one, because when you decide to exit, how much of that concentration is dependent on you as being the one who is the... So, think about some of the creative businesses. Think about an ad agency. Think about some of the really, really creative businesses. Maybe the founder is the one who was the strong creative individual, and those large clients always wanted the founder had to personally be the one generating their new campaigns. Well, that could be very, you could see how difficult that could be to exit. If the concentration of a customer base is highly concentrated, that makes an exit that much more difficult if you need a high payout at exit. So you see, a lot of these things are overlapping each other.
Yeah, they are, because the very characteristic of a great startup entrepreneur may also have characteristics that make it difficult for them to let go and to build up the bench and to not necessarily be the star of the show that everybody wants to be a part of. I mean, it's sort of like you get one thing, but you get something else in addition.
That's right.
Yeah. That's right. Fascinating. Yeah. But Steve, I really love your perspective on this. And I could talk with you all day and all this sort of stuff. Tell people, you know, who haven't gotten to know you before, how can they connect with you? And what's coming up? Is there anything that we should be looking from you that we may want to be aware of? A book, for example, or some sort of thing that you might be doing that we could pay attention to?
Well, I already did publish a book. I'll say it's my first book, because right now it's my first and only book of don't know. On the visual, but I mean, I know this is a podcast, but if parts of this are going to be recorded, if a portion that is visible is visible. This is the book that a few years ago I published, which is called What Happens After the Sale. And that book was not because my objective was to sell thousands and thousands and thousands of copies of the book, but it was a case history. And it deals with some of the steps, like what you're asking about, of how does someone go along? Because it was a case history of one of my clients who is a privately held company and was looking at where he was going to go, and the possibility of a sale to a public company occurred. So that became a way that people are going to overlap. And some of my investment banker friends have said to me that when we look at the future in this country, and when we look at the generations where we are of in terms of the baby boomers and different type of demographics, that the figure I have been told is that in the next 10 years, 5 million companies in this country are going to change hands. 5 million.
Wow.
That's enormous. So when we think about some next step things, there's going to be a lot of need for these kind of conversations and investigation. So, you know, where I am as I've moved in my career along from the corporate world, phase one, to privately held companies, phase two of running middle market companies. Now, for the last 20 years, I've been dealing with the coaching activity. So all of my time now is spent dealing with people that I want to work with. And so I'd say I'm fortunate where I am in that I used to really worry about maximizing the clients and needing certain income for it to help my kids go to college and all of that. Well, I'm beyond that. And so the nice aspect of where I am in that kind of life cycle is that I can really look at a candidate or a potential client and only take people that I want to work with. So therefore, in choosing clients or companies, the space that I'm in is dealing, I do not deal with publicly traded companies. I'm not dealing with giant firms. I'm dealing with people that need an individual to talk to, in other words, the coaching relationship. Mm-hmm. And they don't typically have a board of directors because most of these privately held companies really don't operate with a board. The relationship that I'm looking for, and therefore the flip side of that, the kind of client or prospect that would be a good fit is someone who's looking for to be getting into conversations of a very personal and confidential nature because they haven't had that. In their own organizations.
Right.
So therefore, you know, I mean, I have openings. I'm not at 100% of my time, but frankly, I don't want to be working any longer at 100% of my time. I have 5 grandchildren and so family time and personal time is, you know, I don't want to put in 60, 70 hours a week as much as I used to. So it goes along that. And so therefore, you know, people can be in touch with me. There is a website that I have. I think you have that, those addresses that I've provided. And there's a calendar feature that people, if they want to just talk about with no obligation, but just have a discovery conversation, which is to say, just, you know, what is this coaching stuff? Is it the same as consulting? I mean, how does it differ? If someone just wanted to have a conversation, really without any obligations, but just let's just get to learn a little more about each other. That's a good way of thinking about some next conversation.
Good. Well, Steve, thank you so much for being a guest, and I wish you the very best. And you know, when this was recorded, we were just a couple of days before Thanksgiving in 2021. So I hope you have a great time with your family and your kids and your grandkids, and best of luck to you in the future.
Yeah, thank you. You too. I wish you the same. And I know a lot of the different types of audience that you interact with and that your people, probably some of the things we've talked about, I wouldn't be surprised at all if these very highly overlap with the things that you're finding or that your people are finding with your clients.
Excellent.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.